Hi, this is Gilbert Gottfried, and this is Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast. I'm here once again with my co-host Frank Santopadre, and we're once again recording at Nutmeg with our engineer Frank Verderosa. Our guest this week is a disc jockey, radio personality, former game show host, and one of the most active and recognized voice actors of the past 40 years. He started out his career at the ripe old age of 15, just like someone else we all know and love, as a DJ at WIRL in Peoria, and would go on to host shows on top 40 and country music stations everywhere, from Fort Wayne to New York City, developing a collection of character voices as he went from 1973 to 2007. He was the essential part of the popular Imus in the Morning show, entertaining audiences with a vast repertoire of celebrity impersonations, including Richard Nixon, Andy Rooney, John Wayne, Howard Cosell, and General George Patton. In 1978, he replaced former podcast guest Chuck McCann as the voice of Cocoa Puffs mascot Sonny the Cocoa Bird.
Cuckoo Bird.
A cuckoo bird, yes. And a year later, he was replaced... He replaced the original actor, Jim Dukas.
Dukas.
As
Jim, you really should read these before.
Jim Dukas.
Jim Dukas.
Yeah. As the voice of the Lugosi-esque cereal pitchman, Count Chocula. He's also lent his voice to dozens of commercials from everything from Skittles to Mighty Dog to the game Operation and Hungry Hungry Hippos, but to millions of kids who came of age in the 1980s and 90s, he'll forever be known as the voice of Lion-O, the leader of the humanoid alien super team, Thundercats, voicing numerous characters for this show, as well as Rankin Bass follow-up companion series, Silverhawks. And if all this wasn't enough to earn her admiration, he also served on the one-time host of the legendary TV game show, Bowling for Dollars. Please welcome to the show a man of a thousand voices, our very own pin pal, Larry Kenny.
Oh, my God. Thank you, Gilbert. You know, I...
some of those things were accurate.
Well, I'm listening to him do that, and I'm thinking, who is this guy? This is the guy I want to meet. He did all of that, you know? But when you think about it, it's not that much. But, you know, my son, Tanner.
Tanner is here with us.
He's here in the other room. He's not allowed in the studio.
With his wife, Katie. They're here.
That's right.
Lovely
and,
people.
And he got me on. He's been listening since you started, I think. And he just always, you know, going on and on. You got to listen to Gilbert's podcast. So I listen. And then I knew I was being invited to be on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm listening to the shows, I listened to just last night to Richard Benjamin.
Uh-huh.
This is a great show.
Yeah, it was one of our best.
Tony Orlando, I listened to
quite
a lot of that. And as I'm listening to him, I thought, what the hell am I doing there? Because, you know, you would come on at the beginning of each one saying, our guest today is an actor who's won 14 Oscars and as a singer... has been on the charts for 37 weeks in a row. He'll be opening later this week on Broadway in the title role of Waiting for Godot. And he invented oxygen. So why does he want me there? What am I going to talk about, you know?
Well, you got plenty to talk about.
Well,
that's an accurate Gilbert impression, except for the fact that you read the you did the copy straight and clean.
Yes.
That's pretty good, Gil.
Thank you.
We've had several people do you on the show.
He didn't misread oxygen.
No. Or Waiting for Godot.
Yes. Now,
welcome to the show, Larry.
Thank you, Frank, very much.
Now, since you were the voice of Count Chocula,
yeah.
And then at the same time, they had a Boris Karloff voice for Frankenberry.
Wasn't that McFadden?
No. Bob McFadden did Frankenberry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There were three, they called them the monster cereals.
And then there was a Peter Lorre.
It was a Booberry.
That was Booberry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I did Count Chocula.
Yes.
Boy, I'm still the voice of Count Chocula for that cereal. I'm still the voice of Cocoa Puffs and Count Chocula, although we haven't done any Count Chocula voices commercials for quite a while.
See, because we had on Bela Lugosi Jr.
Really?
We did.
And he's a lawyer. And one of his biggest cases that he's always after is people doing imitations of established actors.
Uh-huh. Especially Bela Lugosi, I would imagine.
Yeah, Lugosi.
Yeah.
Yeah, that used to be just every cartoon, every commercial.
Well, I remember when I started doing it, it had been done for years by Jim Dukas.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, he was doing Count Chocula. And Chuck McCann was doing Cocoa Puffs.
Oh, Sonny. Yeah, we had Chuck here on
Sonny
the show.
Sonny the Cocoa Puffs bird, yeah. So in 78, I think, I got a chance to start doing Sonny the Cocoa Puffs bird, which if you haven't heard of him, then you don't have children because he's all over the television, usually on Saturday mornings and after schools during cartoon shows and things like that. And he sounds like, up here, I won't go cuckoo for my favorite cereal. Munchy, crunchy, chocolatey Cocoa Puffs. Yahoo! I'm cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
How do you get up that high? You were...
Let's don't go into that.
You obviously a deep voice fellow.
Because I remember, as far as like doing known voices, years ago, there was like Columbo Yogurt.
Yeah.
And they had a guy doing a Peter Falk imitation for all the radio.
I remember that.
I don't either.
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were
Columbo Yogurt.
Yeah. So they were ripping off two things, him and the Columbo series.
The series, yeah. What did he said? What he probably said, I don't want to bother you, but try Columbo Yogurt.
Yeah. Like that.
Yeah. How did Count Chocula happen? Well, Sonny happened first.
For me, Sonny
McCann
happened,
was doing it for a long time.
Yeah. Chuck McCann had been doing it, and then, from what I understand, he moved to California from New York to do some television, movies out there, and it became too difficult for him to fly back, back and forth, or too expensive, or whatever.
It's funny in those days you couldn't just do it on a computer and send it across the country.
That's right. Yeah.
Wow.
Now you can, and so they auditioned. Again, I know probably a couple hundred actors, and it was actually pretty easy because they wanted to maintain the same established voice of Sonny. They didn't want to, because the kids were used to it, and they didn't want it to be obvious that somebody new was doing Sonny. So all I had to do was listen to, of course, I had grown up with it, the voice, and I just had to listen to it over and over till I got it well enough that I got the job. And then a year or two later, Jim Dukas retired, and I won the audition for Count Chocula. So it's interesting. You said that Bela Lugosi Jr.
Yeah,
he's cracking down on all these people who imitate established stars.
The Stooges too. Yeah,
yeah. I can understand that. With Count Chocula, I remember them telling me, even at the audition, we don't want it to sound just like Bela Lugosi. We want it to sound more cartoony.
So that's what my Count Chocula was more like. Count Chocula cereal with chocolate-flavored marshmallows. It's frighteningly delicious. So that wasn't really a Bela Lugosi.
A happy Lugosi, like Lugosi on Prozac.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
No, Lugosi on Cocoa Puffs. Uh-huh. I heard that one of the greatest stories I've ever heard, Richard Dawson told it many years ago. I remember the interview for two reasons. And I forget who was interviewing him, maybe Dick Cavett. And I'm watching on television. And the first reason that I remember it so well was I was amazed. I was only probably a high school kid at the time. I was amazed. I had never heard anybody, a foreigner, a British actor, for example, do an American accent. And he did an American accent very, very well. And I sat there and I thought, well, of course they can do it too. But I never before had thought.
It went both ways.
Yeah. We do accents, French accents and German and Spanish and all that. But to have them do us, it freaked me out. And the second part was that it was such a funny story that Richard Dawson told. And he swore at the time it was true. I don't think it really was, but it's one of those stories that you wish it, you hope it is. Mm-hmm. You hope it's a true story.
This whole show is based on this story. If you go back into the archives and listen,
say if it sounds good, then it's true.
The hell with it.
Yeah. Print a legend.
Good enough for me if it sounds true. So Dawson tells this story, and I haven't told this in 50 years, so I hope I get it right. But it's Bela Lugosi has died. And as you probably know, he died penniless, really. He had a severe heroin problem.
Yeah.
Lingered for many years and did some movies he wouldn't have done otherwise, you know.
Yeah, he got tied in with the Ed Wood
stuff.
The only guy who would hire him.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Well, he died penniless. And Boris Karloff, the story goes, was a dear friend of his.
Oh, I know this one.
Oh, you know this story? And you want to tell him?
I don't know it.
No. This has to do with Boris Karloff and Peter Lorre.
No.
This one. Okay.
Different one.
This is maybe a different one.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell mine, then you tell yours, and we'll see how they So he died, and Boris Karloff is, just devastated. His friend has passed away. And he's more devastated that he's probably going to, if he doesn't do something, he's going to have just a funeral with three people there, and in a wooden box or something. So Karloff gets on the phone and calls every major star in Hollywood and says, "You owe it to Bela to be there. He was a dear friend of all of us." Well, it turns out that Lugosi had at that time the biggest funeral Hollywood had ever seen, all because of Karloff, who, also the story goes, bought probably thousands of dollars worth of flowers. They had like 20 cars of flowers in the funeral lineup heading out to the cemetery. So they're at the cemetery now, and Lugosi's religion, whatever it was, or from his culture over in Romania, wherever he was from, provided that the casket be left open at the cemetery. And that's where you would file by and say your final goodbyes, and then they would, lower him down to the ground. So the story goes, according to Dawson, that Karloff stood there for hours while this eternal line of stars walked by and paid their last respects to Bela Lugosi. And when the last person had gone, and the only people there were the grave diggers and Karloff, Karloff walks over to the casket, and they had Lugosi with a cape on, his cape.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think they had the teeth, but that would be a little tacky. But Karloff walks over, looks down in the coffin, and says, "Bela, if you're putting me on."
That's the story.
I heard it with Lorre.
Where Karloff was standing with Peter Lorre.
Uh-huh.
And depending on who tells the story, either Boris Karloff says that line or Peter Lorre says that line.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think Karloff and Lugosi were ever friends.
Well, in Ed Wood, he calls him a cocksucker.
Oh, yes.
but we asked Bela Jr., and he said, "My father never used that kind of language." He was actually very upset when he saw the film.
A douse up the bullfrog, Jinnig. A word from one of our sponsors.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
We need to go.
Hang on. It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
It's Gilbert and Frank's Amazing Colossal Podcast.
Now, unfortunately, we return to our show.
As long as we're on the subject
yes.
of Count Chocula.
Well, thanks a lot. You've just destroyed a story that I've, you know,
yes.
has been dear to me for most of my life. Maybe Karloff walked over and said, good.
Don't get used to the stories on this show being factual.
Here, Gil. Now this, we're going to just
try something fun.
All right.
What the hell?
Famous last words.
Now, Gilbert, you were known for doing Dracula Gottfried on the Howard Show.
Yes, and on Howard Stern.
And, yeah. and you do a pretty mean Lugosi, and we know what Larry does. So
now the only person missing would, I guess, be Joe Flattery.
You mean Count Floyd.
Yes.
But what we have here is Count Chocula and Dracula Gottfried. So I thought we'd give this a try. And your parts are clearly marked.
Okay. You are too late, Van Helsing. My blood now flows through her veins. She will live through the centuries to come as I have lived.
Kids love watching the hidden marshmallow ghosts appear in my delicious... I'm doing the wrong damn voice.
You're doing Coke.
I'm doing the
Sonny
wrong voice.
The
yeah, that I thought
we're supposed to be dueling Dracula.
I don't remember at what point in Lugosi's career he ever actually sounded like that.
That's a lot of morphine.
I don't remember in any part of Dracula him going, I'm Count Dracula.
You mean you don't remember that famous line?
Listen to the children of the night. What music they make.
I'm sorry.
Take two.
Take two.
I'm cuckoo for blood.
All right, you're doing the real
set him up again.
Dracula, yeah. And I'm doing the Count Chocula.
Yes,
Dracula.
Yes.
Now
yes.
I've got
set
it.
Set him up again.
Okay. There we can edit this later.
Yeah. It's too good. We'll keep it.
All right.
Give him the last line, Gil.
Okay. As I have lived.
Kids love watching the hidden marshmallow ghosts appear in my delicious Count Chocula cereal.
The spider. The spider spinning his web for an unwary fly. The blood is the life. Mr. Enfield.
Now you can let Igor guard your Count Chocula cereal and get a pack of fun gummy spiders inside my shiny spider box.
A shiny spider box?
Yeah, I wouldn't touch that line with a 10-foot pole.
That is actual Count Chocula copy. I'll have you know.
That's when Lugosi was doing porn later in his career.
The girl with the shiny spider box.
Yes.
What music she makes.
Go ahead, Gil. You're up.
Your line.
To die, to be really dead, must be glorious. There are far worse things awaiting man than death.
Count Chocula now offers even more chocolatey marshmallows for a chocolatey fright in every bite.
Listen to them, children of the night. What music they make.
All right.
Very good.
That's a great Lugosi.
A couple of false
thank
starts.
You.
That's great.
It worked.
I just got a compliment on my Lugosi from Count Chocula.
I have to admit, you're scarier than me. But you see, I am not allowed to be scary. You're frightening the children. You know?
Were you also almost Lucky the Leprechaun?
Almost Lucky the Leprechaun.
What
the story
there?
Of my life, I was almost
oh,
lucky.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I had been doing Count Chocula and Cocoa Puffs for a number of years. And the guy who had been doing Lucky, the Lucky Charms Leprechaun.
Yeah.
I forget his name now. Arthur something. Got very old and could no longer perform, you know, as well as they wanted him to. So they, again, held auditions, you know, 200 people went in. And I didn't think anything about it. But the next couple of days later, I had a recording session for either Count Chocula or Cocoa Puffs. And I walked into the studio, and the director was the same guy, Deed Meyer, from the agency, the ad agency, who directed all of these, they call them the monster serials, Cocoa Puffs. Well, no.
Yeah.
Count Chocula.
Frankenberry.
Frankenberry and Boo Berry.
Don't forget Yummy Mummy.
Yummy Mummies for about 6 weeks that lasted.
And Fruit Brute.
Fruit Brutes, that's right.
Yeah, the werewolf.
So those were called the General Mills monster serials. But they also made, and still do, Lucky Charms and a couple of others. So I walk into this recording session for one of the other two serials. And Deed Meyer says to me, Larry, dear boy, you won the audition as Lucky the Leprechaun. And I said, oh, really? Good.
Yeah.
Yes, but I poo-pooed that idea because I told him he's already doing the Count and Sonny. If something happens to him, we're out three mascots. And I said, well, okay, I understand, Dee. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, oh, thanks. You just cost me like $50,000 a year, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the way it goes.
Let's hear a little bit of luck of what your Lucky would have been.
Always after me Lucky Charms.
It's a little Barry Fitzgerald, right?
Of course. Yeah. All my Irish accents are Barry Fitzgerald. Toot-toot, my boy.
Now, are there, I mean, I remember it used to be like for cartoon, I mean, major animated Disney cartoons and commercials, there were the voiceover guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it's like voiceover guys are like, you know, Gene Hackman, Sean Connery.
Gilbert Gottfried.
Yes.
Yes. John Hamm.
There used to be those voiceover guys.
You mean the cartoon guys like Mel Blanc and Dawes Butler?
Yeah,
and,
or those guys? Yeah. Or they were like...
Paul Frees.
There was this actor, Norman Rose.
With the deepest voice in the world.
Norman Rose.
We called him the voice of God.
Yes.
And
I thought John Fazenda was the voice of God.
Norman. Yeah,
right.
Norman died about 15 years ago. But Norman had this very, very deep voice. And there was some commercial he did in New York that were indicative of that. I'm the Hemlock Farms deer. Remember that? So I'm at an audition one time with Norman Rose for I don't know what product. Yeah. It was a radio commercial. And so it says on the script, voice of God, and then other guy, you know. Well, obviously, Norman's going to do the voice.
Yeah.
So he does. We go one take with him as the voice of God and me as other guy. And the director says, what was her name? Nancy Field. She says, okay, good, guys. Switch it around. Larry, you be voice of God. And I thought, what? I'm in the studio with Norman Rose, you know, the voice of God. But we do it. Few days go by, I get a call from my agent. Larry, you're booked on this commercial. Good. I go in there and I grab my copy and I start rehearsing the other guy role. And Nancy says, no, Larry, you're doing the voice of God. I said, what, Norman was busy? And she said, how can I, Norman Rose is the voice of God.
Yeah.
And she said, yes, Larry, but you are the God of voices.
Wow.
Wasn't that nice?
How sweet.
You know, it's funny. I remember going to a voiceover session, and there was a guy in ahead of me, and it was Norman Rose. Mm. And you hear that voice, and it's so funny with these voiceover guys where you go, holy shit, there's an actual person?
Yeah, you see it coming out of him.
That's not a machine doing that?
Yeah.
Yeah, because his voice would rattle the walls.
Oh, I mean, yeah. So he could only be God.
You know, he wore a codpiece, Norman.
Are you serious?
I swear to God.
Well, that's the first time in 170 shows we've brought up a codpiece.
Most people probably don't know what it is. You explain
Ian Anderson, and the lead singer of Jethro Tull, famously wore a codpiece.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
It's an external, how do you describe it? It's an external piece of clothing that goes over your member.
Your thing.
Your thing.
And there was another voiceover guy I knew. God, watch me forget his name now. Lenny Maxwell.
Lenny Maxwell.
Oh, I knew Len Maxwell.
He did great voices.
Sure.
And he was, I remember him telling me, and it's a funny thing about voiceover guys, is aside from like crazy voices that they'll do, they'll have like he said, I've got about 5 or 6 normal voices.
Yeah.
And it's funny, like they'll have these voices where you'd say, oh, no, that's just the guy talking.
Yeah.
But they'll have like variations. They'll have just a guy talking happy.
Yeah.
Just a guy talking serious. You know, it's very, very incredible.
It really is the same as being a dialectician in a way. You know, it's doing different voices, and different, like as you just described, you know. You reminded me of something when you mentioned, you mentioned that it used to be just voiceover guys who did the cartoons and things like that. The reason for that was, up until 20 or 25 years ago, big actors wouldn't be caught dead doing commercials.
Oh, oh,
that's what you told me on the phone.
Yeah, would they?
Yeah.
Because it was considered beneath them.
Yeah.
And, you know, there wasn't that much money available back then, too. They're, you know, because they didn't have to pay us union people that much money.
It's funny. Like now you see like Academy Award winners in commercials.
Yeah.
But then what started happening, all these people who were too big of artists to do a commercial would go to Japan.
Yes. Frank Sinatra did commercials for some car.
I believe he did.
In Japan for years. Yeah. For years. And it was stipulation was hard and fast that nobody outside of Japan can ever see these, you know. Can't be put on television anywhere else or whatever, but yeah, they didn't. I think they felt most of them that it would seem to the public that they needed the money, you know.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
And there was also this is a question I always wondered, with the exception of one episode of Family Guy, where they did a takeoff on Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd. And they had Noah Blank do the voices, but he never did any of the Warner Brothers. I think Mel was trying, you know, getting him ready. He was trying to brush him up, but they never hired him to do those.
I remember, pardon me, when Mel Blank died, I remember hearing that his son, I didn't know his name was Noah,
I think it's Noel.
Noel. I remember hearing that his son was going to take over Bugs Bunny and Yosemite Sam and all those things. And then the next thing you hear is that somebody else has been hired. We started auditioning for all those voices. And I just assumed that the guy didn't do them well enough. They wanted somebody else to do them.
Yeah, I always wondered what Noel was doing all those years.
I can't believe you brought up Len Maxwell, I hope I'm right on this, was on the Milton the Monster show with your friend McFadden.
Probably.
Bob McFadden.
Yeah.
Who we should also talk about now that we're on the subject of these
Bob
guys, because you worked with Bob on Thundercats.
I worked with Bob.
And he's a legend.
Yeah, Bob and I worked.
His name's come up on this show.
Has it?
Well, we were talking about a show called Cool McCool.
Yeah.
With Bob Kane's show from the 60s.
Cool McCool.
And that was, that was Bob McFadden.
I think he was also...
He was Milton the Monster.
Some dog. There was a dog.
Milton the Monster, that was a Jim Neighbors imitation.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
He was also Frankenberry.
Yeah, he was Frankenberry for many, many years.
Yeah. And here's one after your own heart, Gil. He was the voice of the parrot in the famous Whisk Ring Around the Collar commercial.
Oh, my God.
Bob McFadden.
Yeah, he was a great guy, too. I worked with him closely for years because
like I said, we worked on the General Mills cereal commercials. And when I first started doing Cocoa Puffs and Count Chocula, they were doing commercials with all three cereals, all three Monster cereals, in the same commercial. We wouldn't do individual commercials for Count Chocula or Cocoa Puffs or...
Booberry.
Booberry, thank you.
Yeah.
They would all appear in the same commercial. So Bob and I worked for years on those, and then Thundercats came along. And that took us a year to record that. And then we did Silverhawks, the same company, Rankin Bass. He was on that. He was on another one we did called Tiger Sharks. And then he and I and most of the same cast of those cartoon series did a series of holiday specials for Rankin Bass. Some of them still get aired every year.
Yeah, I found some of them on YouTube.
Yeah, one of them was called A Star for Jeremy.
They're out there.
The Life and Adventures of Santa Claus. I remember working with Sir Alfred Drake on that.
Oh,
one.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sir Alfred Drake.
Speaking of deep voices.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Since you said Alfred, I want to throw this because I wrote it on a card. Apparently, Count Chocula has a first name. And it's Alfred.
I didn't know that.
Did you know that?
I did.
Okay.
I did not know that.
Show is educational.
Because you know why? Because most people just call me the Count. You know, who's going to say, hey, Alfred, I love your cereal. You know.
McFadden was also in Vaughn Meader. He was on Vaughn Meader's first family album.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he did a lot of cool stuff.
Produced by Earl Dowd, who hired me years later to do a Richard Nixon album.
Oh.
Yeah. Because I was doing Nixon on Imus's show.
Right, sure.
This was back in 73, I think. Yeah, 73. I was working in Chicago as a disc jockey, and Earl Dowd called me. And I knew his name, you know, from... I mean, the first family album, for those who don't know, was about John F. Kennedy and his family.
Yeah, it's come up on this show.
And at the time, back in that time, it became the largest selling album of all times. Not just comedy albums. The largest selling albums of all time.
Oh, he was very big.
He was very good, too. And
Vaughn Meader.
Who in the old Warner Brothers cartoons, the Bugs Bunny ones, mm-hmm. who did the movie stars? Like, you know, where they visit a restaurant.
Clark Gable and people
Bogart
like that.
Bogart and Gable.
I don't know.
We'll have to dig that out. We'll put that out to our listeners.
Yeah.
Somebody will come up with it.
Yeah, I don't know who that was.
I remember hearing a story that one time they hired Peter Lorre to do a Peter Lorre imitation. And they said, okay, your first line is, hi, I'm Peter Lorre. And he went, hi, I'm Peter Lorre. And the guy goes, no. Hi, I'm Peter Lorre.
Yeah.
And he goes, hi, I'm Peter Lorre. And he couldn't do
himself
a Peter Lorre imitation.
Yeah, because people who do imitations, usually impressions, they exaggerate. That's how you get the, you know, like when I started doing Nixon, people who were doing Richard Nixon, most impressionists were doing Richard Nixon's, I'm going to be the president, you know, my name is Richard Nixon. Well, he never talked like that.
Yeah.
You know, he talked more like this, you know.
Oh, yeah.
People wonder if I'm a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I look like a crook. I act like a crook, but I'm not a crook.
So you did an album.
Yeah. Earl Dowd called me and he said, and I knew who he was, and he said, I'm doing this album called The Honest to God, We Really Mean It, Very Last Nixon Album. And this was in maybe August of 73.
Mm-hmm.
So I fly to New York from Chicago, and by the time I get, he's got the rest of the cast. Julie Newmar played Pat Nixon.
Wow!
Man.
Yeah, Marshall Efron was.
I remember Marshall Efron.
It was David Eisenhower.
Oh, Marshall Efron.
Marshall Efron. There's a voice for.
Oh, him. Okay. He used to be. There was that show like Great American, something. There was
the kids show.
Yeah, I know what you're referring to.
And Marshall Efron was also in a movie I like very much, Bang the Drum Slowly.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, he worked a lot.
Was that about the baseball player?
Yeah, with De Niro.
Yeah, and De Niro played the character, lead character.
And Michael Moriarty.
Yeah. So we recorded it at Media Sound on 57th Street over two nights. We did it four times with four different audiences.
And it actually was a pretty good album. But by the time we finished it and got it out, it was like April of 74. Well, by that time, everybody knew he was a crook.
Right,
you know,
the clock was ticking.
The clock was ticking. We knew he was going to be gone. So it was kind of a bad timing to come out. But it was a pretty good album.
I'll look for that.
Yeah.
It, just for the record, just so no one has to correct me, I think it was the Great American Dream Machine.
That sounds right.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Nice reference.
Trying to remember one of the bits on the album. A couple of the bits on the Nixon album, of course, were like parodies. Mm-hmm. Like, remember on the First Family album where the little girl comes to the White House door and she knocks. Somebody opens and says, "Can I help you?" And she says, "Can the president come out and play?" And they say, "Well, I'm sorry, dear. He's very busy." "Oh, well then, what's Lyndon doing?" So we reprised that on the Nixon album where the little girl knocks. "Can the president come out and play?" And I say, "Why, yes. Yes, I can." And she says, "Oh, shit."
What's the name of this album? I got to find it.
It's called, get your pencils out, The Honest to God, yeah. We Really Mean It, Very Last Nixon Album.
By the producer of First Family.
By Earl Dowd. Yeah. And it was on Brunswick Records.
You know the
bowling ball company?
Sure.
Brunswick Records. That was another bit where I remember it was David Eisenhower, Marshall Efron. Marshall comes up to Nixon and he says, "Mr. President, I really hesitate to bring this up." "What is it, David? Just spit it out." "Well, sir, it's kind of embarrassing." He says, "Look, David, I don't have all day. All right, got the water at the gate thing going on and all that. So what is it?" He says, "Well, sir, if you recall, 2 weeks ago, you didn't have any cash when we were out, and I lent you $20. He says, "Oh, yes. Yes, I remember that. I'm so sorry. Here, I've only got singles." He says, "That's okay, mister." There you go, David. "I'm sorry." And you hear David walking away going, "One, two, three, four," and then you hear, "It's all there, David."
You know what else I thought as far as getting back to imitations? It's like, it's already accepted that we all believe that John Travolta, in every one of his movies or in real life, sounds like Vinnie Barbarino. And that was only once in his career.
Right.
But people do a Vinnie Barbarino imitation.
Yeah. It sticks.
And we just accept that in the
Mr. Carter.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Carter.
Or another one like that is we all accept that Keanu Reeves sounds like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, no matter what.
One role sticks to them forever. I want to ask you something about character voices. Did you ever audition for anything like that, like a character mascot? Well, obviously.
Oh, yes. I mean, oh, boy.
Apart from the duck.
Yes.
I'm in an animated.
Oh, I just remembered that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm in an animated one. Did you do a toaster?
Yes. I was a toaster for a Pop-Tarts commercial.
Okay. Wait, can anyone find that? Do you have that?
I think you could find that on the internet.
YouTube. You can find all those old things on YouTube.
You always do your own voice.
Yeah, yes. Right. I was an elf.
Right.
For something like Federal Express.
Okay. Maybe. How about Keebler Cookies? Was it Keebler Cookies?
No. Never got that account. Let's see. There was that and that. Oh, one time. This is one of those things that I lost the job without being responsible for it.
A fluke.
Yes. Exactly. They were going to make a full-length animated Betty Boop.
Oh, and you never told me this.
Yeah. And I was looking. They had me come into audition for the clown. And while I was waiting, I was flipping the pages, and they go to a party where Humphrey Bogart and Edward G. Robinson and Clark Gable and Cary Grant are there. And I said, can I audition for these? And they said, okay. And I did all these different celebrities, and they wanted me. But the movie never got made.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, boy, how much I would have loved to have done that.
You probably hadn't done a movie before that, had you?
Would
that have been your first movie?
Yeah.
That's why you're probably so disappointed.
Yeah. Boom Boom
Burmese from Karate Cat sounded a little like Edward G. Robinson. Am I mistaken?
No. Boom Boom Burmese sounded like...
It sounds like you bailed the ghost him.
What I just did sounded like Mel Brooks. I don't know where that came from. No, wait. I think that Boom Boom was, he was this big fat cat. It was on a show called...
was it Karate Cat?
Karate Cat. Bob McFadden was Karate Cat.
That's right.
Karate Cat here. And I was one of his gang. He was, you know, like nefarious.
Right.
And Big Mama ran the mob. So I remember lines like,
Karate, here comes Big Mama, and she's not happy.
There wasn't a character with you doing an Edward G. Robinson impression?
Yeah, I don't think so.
I'm mistaken. Okay.
Could be. It could be.
The frog on Courageous Cat was Edward G. Robinson. Do you remember it, Gil?
Oh, yes.
I was telling Larry on the phone that what's his name? Simon Bar Sinister on Underdog was Lionel Barrymore.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You do a great Barrymore right now.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I do it because there's a lot of kids in the audience.
He said he does Barry Manilow.
I heard a great story about Mel Blanc. Well, this first part's not great. He almost died in a car accident.
Really?
Mel Blanc.
Way to lighten the tone up.
Oh, yes. But he was in a coma. They thought he was going to die. He was in a coma for the longest time. and the doctor kept saying, Mr. Blank, can you please talk to me? Can you please say hello? And then finally, the doctor went over to him and he said, I'd like to talk to Bugs Bunny.
Oh, wow.
And he immediately...
That's a great story.
Lying there in his hospital bed, immediately Bugs Bunny's voice came out.
That's amazing.
And then he said, now I'd like to talk to Daffy Duck. And he started doing his Daffy voice.
I was certain you were going to say... They told him he wasn't going to make it. He said,
that's all, folks.
I think that's on his headstone.
Yes, that's right. That's all, folks.
Yeah. Did you ever work with any of those other guys? Did you ever work with
I'm not that old, Frank.
June Foray or Dawes Butler Don Messick or any of those?
No, June Foray was one of the greatest.
She's still with us at like 99 or something.
For those of you who remember Boris Bedenoff and Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Sure. Paul Frees.
Paul Frees.
Well, yeah, it was Boris
Bedenoff. Paul Frees was also, for about 30 or 40 years, the voice of the Pillsbury Doughboy.
That's correct. Yeah. And I was just down at the Haunted Mansion in Florida in Disney World, and they still have Paul Frees' voice.
Oh,
when you walk in,
and
he's been dead 20 years or something, when you walk into the mansion.
Paul Frees was the voice of the Cyclops in the movie The Cyclops with Lon Chaney Jr.
He had an unmistakable voice.
But his voice in this was like, it was ridiculous. The Cyclops is too big and dumb to talk. So it was like,
didn't have to have a script, right?
Yes, yeah.
All right, as long as we're talking about some of these characters, I'm just going to run through.
Can I interject one thing?
Yeah, sure.
Do you guys,
you're the guest.
This is a little bit of a trivia question. Probably not to you guys, but do you know who was the announcer on most of the segments of Rocky and Bullwinkle?
William Conrad.
Conrad, that's right. Yes. From the fat man and
Cannon.
Yeah.
Oh, Cannon.
And Jake and the Fat Man.
That voice. Yeah.
Oh, he had a great voice.
I believe he was Marshall Dillon on the radio.
On the radio he was, but for obvious reasons he's not on television.
Right.
Because Marshall Dillon.
There wasn't a horse that big. But he was the guy who would say,
and so, Moose and Squirrel go to the bottom of Veronica Lake.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Thank you.
I like that.
And now...
Let me throw some of these characters
used that voice. It just occurred to me, I'm sorry, but I used that voice for years without realizing that's who I was doing on Mighty Dog commercials.
Oh, that's right. Well, that was in your intro, so let's hear a little Mighty Dog.
Carnation presents The Adventures of Mighty Dog.
That's all I remember.
I love that. Recognize that one, Gil?
I've had more than one voiceover guy say to me, oh, I was up for a voiceover gig, and the director said, could you make it more Gilbert Gottfried?
Really?
Yeah, and I thought, I'm available.
Well...
Did you ever get that direction, Larry? Yeah. I bet not.
No, but I have been to, and probably a lot of voice actors have had the same experience. I have, on more than one occasion, showed up at an audition where it said, sometimes they give you an idea of the type they want, or even who they want to sound like. And they said, think of someone, and they said, like Larry Kenny.
Oh!
And I didn't get the job.
It's like Peter Lorre.
Yeah. And I, to this day, I wonder who in the hell sounded more like me than me.
I took the liberty of writing out some of your characters, tracking down some of your characters. I have your list here, too, Gilbert. Boom Boom Burmese, we talked about. Lion-O, of course. We'll have you do some Lion-O before we sign off. You were Jackal Man.
Yes. We must get the Thundercats, yes.
What are you doing there? Is that just kind of sort of like a sinister? It's almost a little Paul Winchell.
Well, you know, yes, Paul Winchell, speaking of voices. You know what my inspiration for that was? I mean, it sounds to say my inspiration for this cartoon character. I brought deep from within me. The name of the character was Jackal Man.
Jackal Man.
And the show was half cat and half human characters.
Right.
So I remember at the audition, I was thinking, what would a jackal sound like? Would jackals are supposed to be like very wily, I think, and, sneaky. And then I got this thought in my head of, speaking of Rocky and Bullwinkle, of not Boris Badenoff, but the other villain. Remember? Hello, Nell.
Snidely Whiplash.
Snidely Whiplash.
Yes.
So I combined the two and kind of made it. I kind of combined them, and it came out.
We must get the Thundercats, yes.
Very good. What about Safari Joe?
Oh, that's pretty obvious. Safari Joe here. He was Australian, you know. I don't know why I'm not doing an Australian voice, but
it was good enough.
I'm doing
Alfred Drake again,
East London
right.
for some reason.
And Snarf Egbert.
Snarf Egbert. Well, Snarf on Thundercats was just. He didn't talk. It was just
meow. Oh, it was just a meow.
Snarf, snarf, snarf.
And Wizra?
Oh, God. That's one of them. You know, I don't remember. Well, we did. There were five of us in the cast of Thundercats, and we did 130 episodes. And there were always new characters, you know. So each of us in the cast over the term of the series probably did 50, 60, maybe 100 voices, you know. In fact, I recall a number of occasions where they would come up with a new voice, and we would all try it, and it took us a while to get one that didn't sound like a voice we had done before, as one of the Lunataks or whatever,
right?
You know, or one of the Rober Burbles, you know. And also, there were characters who appeared, let's say, early in the series, and then didn't appear for 30 episodes, and came back, you know, in episode 125. And who remembers then what you did for it? It was a minor character. It maybe had two or three lines, you know. But the kids remember.
Of course.
You know, I go to these Comic-Cons all the time, and people come up who were kids then. Now, you know, now they're 35 years old. They'll say, like, Mr. Kenny, remember in episode 126? And I'm going, oh, Jesus, here we go.
That's the one, you know, where Lion-O jumps out of the tank, the Thunder Tank, you know, and he's got the Sword of Omens, you know, in his right hand, right? Okay, next shot, boom, swords in his left hand. What's up with that?
they're upset about continuity errors in Thundercats.
I would answer something like, well, you see, one of Lion-O's other superpowers was that he could transform into a mirror image of himself. Figure it out.
I think we've discussed this cartoon, that there was a cartoon that took place in the jungle, and there was a bird that sounded like Jack Lemmon.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, Carl Reiner did an animated show that I think was Jungle Characters. Would that be the one, maybe?
Maybe, but the bird was a Jack Lemmon imitation.
We'll throw it out to our listeners.
Somebody will definitely.
Or our crack researcher, Paul Reburn.
You did a bird in
Aladdin.
Aladdin, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I remember that. I was a small child when it came out.
All right, Gil, here we go. Here's some of your repertoire of animation voices. Iago, of course, which Larry just brought up. Mr. Peabody in the problem child cartoons.
That cartoon was made in, I think, in Spain or something.
Okay.
Well, wasn't that a part of Rocky and Bullwinkle? It was.
Peabody here.
Sherman and Peabody.
Yeah.
Sherman. Set the Wayback Machine to 1847.
Pretty good.
Thank you.
Pretty good. Edward Everett Horton also did those voices Fractured Fairy Tales.
Well, he was the announcer on Fractured Fairy Tales.
How about this? Two Bits, you played on a show called Bonkers. Any of these have any memory for you?
Oh, yes, I did. I did do a voice on Bonkers, my usual.
Mike McNasty?
It sounds
another
familiar.
Character. You played Mr. Beetle?
Mr. Beetle, that was in Thumbelina.
Okay. How about Jerry the Belly Button Elf?
That was in
Ren
and Stimpy.
I have it on the card.
I was Jerry the Belly Button Elf, and so
what the hell is a belly button?
Yeah,
elf?
He sees this elf that lives in a belly
He's
button.
Made out of lint.
And they wanted Jerry Lewis, and he wouldn't do it. So I came in, I would do my regular voice, and then I go, and I'm going to go in the belly button and live and eat my lint loaf. Dinner! Hurry up, boy! I want my dinner!
Right away, Your Majesty, sir. Stimpy, before I eat, a toast to you, my houseboy.
My man Friday. You came into the emptiness that was your belly button, and you filled it with the love and the joy and the thing. And as we all know, an elf without the love and the joy and the thing is no elf at all. And so, a toast to you, Stimpy, and this lovely meal of...
Lint loaf.
I once did a... Jerry Lewis was on Broadway in Damn Yankees for a while, and I at that time was doing a lot of Broadway show commercials for Nancy Coyne, Cyrano Coyne and Nappy, and I finished one, got the tape they liked on it. Call Telecharge to see Jerry Lewis on Broadway in Damn Yankees. Call now. So they said, okay, Larry, we got it. And I said, okay, good, but could we just keep rolling? Because I have an idea. In case he ever comes back, So Nancy knew me, and she went, Larry wants to play. Okay, go ahead. So I went, see Jerry Lewis on Broadway in My Fair Lady.
You couldn't resist.
Couldn't help it.
You were Art DeSalvo in Duckman?
Yes.
Okay. You were Alfalfa. This may be my favorite of your credits. The High Fructose Adventures of Annoying Orange.
Yes. Yes.
That's a Cesar Romero motif. Of course, Horace the Rat. Your Krang Subprime on
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Digit on Cyber Chase. Cyber Chase. This may be my favorite. Well, of course, Superman's
Mrs.
enemy?
Mrs. Pickelick.
Mrs. Pickelick, you were. And last but not least, Odiferous Stench on a show called Bump in the Night.
Oh, yes. Yes. I think I was a stink bug.
And Gilbert, you should be a guest. You should be a guest on this. And I could do the do the announcer's thing.
You've heard him as the elf with the in the belly button elf.
He was in the bump in the night thing.
It's Gilbert meets Jerry there. It's just a little, it's like a hybrid.
And now he's here.
All right, you guys want to try something crazy?
What? This hasn't been crazy enough for
you? Let's see. Gilbert.
You can do Grandpa Joe.
This is a scene from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
All right.
But we're going to change it. We're going to recast it.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
So, Gil, you can either do, I guess, Jerry, you could do Jerry, you could do James Mason, or you could do Jerry Seinfeld, whatever you're feeling.
Oh, okay, I'll do Seinfeld.
And I thought our guest of honor would do his wonderful George C. Scott.
Oh, okay. Well, my George C. Scott that I did on Imus for 35 years was an impression of... George C.
Patton doing George
doing
C. Scott
George
doing
C. Scott.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it'll work here.
I said I'd do Seinfeld.
You're going to change it?
But I had a couple of people say they were very angry because on a recent episode we mentioned James Mason.
Yeah.
And I didn't do my James Mason imitation.
That person was mistaken. He just didn't listen to enough of the episode.
Oh!
It was the Benjamin episode.
Oh.
I got the same tweet.
Oh, okay. So which would you prefer, Mason or Seinfeld?
I think I'd like to hear you do Jerry Seinfeld there.
Okay. And I'm Grandpa?
You're Grandpa Joe, which was, I think, Jack Albertson.
Yes.
Oh, and I'm Willy Wonka.
And Larry is Willy Wonka.
As George C. Scott.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
You'll indulge me.
Of course.
Mr. Wonka.
I am extraordinarily busy, sir.
I just want to ask about the chocolate, the lifetime supply of chocolate for Charlie. When does he get it?
He doesn't.
Why not?
Because he broke the rules.
What rules? We didn't see any rules, did we, Charlie?
Wrong, sir. Wrong. Under Section 37B of the contract signed by him, it states quite clearly that all offers shall become null and void if, and you can read it for yourself in this photostatic copy, I, the undersigned, shall forfeit all rights, privileges, and licenses herein, and herein contained, etc., etc., Fax mentis incendium gloria cultum, etc., etc., memo bis punitor, delicatum. It's all there, black and white, clear as crystal. You stole lifting drinks. You bumped into the ceiling, which now has to be washed and sterilized, so you get nothing. You lose. That is all. Good day, sir.
You're a crook. You're a cheat and a swindler. That's what you are. How could you do something like this? Build up a little boy's hopes, and then smash all his dreams to pieces. You're an inhuman monster.
I said, good day. That's here for the writer.
Yes.
Franks, Santa Padre.
I didn't write it. I just pulled it off the internet. And I looked for a movie scene that I thought would work. We had some success with Gilbert and Mario Cantone doing Carol Channing and Irvy Velasquez and When Harry Met Sally. So just talk a little bit about Imus as we wind down and how you got there. And you had been developing these voices in radio over the years, impressions before you ever got to Imus.
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact.
Because you were a DJ forever before you got to Imus.
Seems like it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. As you mentioned, as Gilbert mentioned, I started in radio when I was 15. And... very soon thereafter began using character voices and, you know, cartoon voices on my disc jockey show. I worked at Peoria and Fort Wayne, and then I went to Cleveland, Ohio, on WKYC, an NBC owned and operated 50,000 watt station. I was there for 3 years, and for the first 2 years I was there, Don Imus was at an opposing station doing the morning show. I was doing afternoons on KYC. He was on WGAR, I think, mm-hmm. doing the morning show. And so then he left to come to New York to WNBC. And I left to go to Chicago to do a morning show. A couple weeks after I'm there in Chicago, I get a call from Imus's engineer, who had been my engineer in Cleveland, because it was NBC.
Oh, that's fun.
Walt Ryan. And he said, hey, I was talking to Don during the show today, and Don said to me,
you were at KYC, right? He said, yeah. He said, Larry Kenny was there. I used to listen to Larry Kenny all the time. And he was, his voices were fantastic. Where is he now? And Walt said, I think he's in New York. And Ima said, why don't you call him and see if he'd want to do bits on my show on the telephone? So Walt called me. And then for a year, right, almost to the day, Don would call me every morning during the newscast. We both had a newscast on the air at the same time. And he would call me and he'd say, let's do a Nixon today. Do something. We'd ad lib it. He'd say, do Nixon. This was during the Watergate thing.
Yeah.
This was in 73. He said, okay, let's do a bit, something, improvise something about what happened yesterday, you know, when they found you do have tapes or something like that. So we would do that for, he paid me $50 a day, I remember. So I did that for a whole year. And then I got a job in New York on the radio, WHN.
Sure. I remember when you were on there.
Yeah. So I came out and was on WHN while he was on WNBC. And then after a while, he hired me to, you know, start doing bits on a regular basis on his show. So,
had you brought all those characters with you? I mean, had the General Patton and Nixon Andy Rooney?
No. No, Charles McCord, who was the newsman on the show, wrote all my every script I ever did on Imus. And we would just come up with new characters whenever they popped into our minds, you know, who can we do this guy
right,
as?
Right, right, right.
You know.
Cosell or.
Yeah. Howard Cosell, yes, did him for years. There, right there. Look at that little monkey running.
He got in trouble for that.
Oh, geez.
He got in trouble for that. Alvin Garrett was the player.
Which was really a shame.
I know.
Because, you know, that's what Howard Cosell called his grandkids, the little monkeys. You know,
right.
And he was, if anything, but a racist.
He wasn't thinking about the ethnicity.
But times as they being what they were, you know, he got, you know, probably ruined his career.
Yeah. You didn't do Imus. You never did the Imus show because you were a Howard guy?
Yeah.
No, it was different camps. Yeah. How long were you there? You were there. Good run.
With Imus?
Yeah.
35 years.
Yeah.
73 to 2008.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Howard, I remember the day that Howard started at WNBC doing afternoons.
Yeah, there was some, they were oil and water, those two.
Yeah, well, what happened was I was sitting in the office when it happened. And this was at a time, this was in probably, I don't know, 82, something like that. I forget when Howard came. But we were sitting in Don's office at 30 Rock, and at that time, Don was having some issues with drinking and drugs, you know, and things like that, and it was not pleasant to be around. And one day, Howard, this new kid, strolled into the office and said, "Hi, guys, how you doing?" Well, Imus went ballistic, and he said, "Get the F out of my office. Who the hell do you think you are? Get out of here." And we were all shocked that he would do that. So Howard left, and to this day, from what I understand, has not forgiven Don Imus.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he hates him with passion. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Don, over the years, has expressed sympathy, regret for what he said, says, you know, because he doesn't drink anymore and do drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Howard really hurt Howard badly, you know?
I don't think that's a peace that's going to be easily brokered.
No.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Why bother?
I got a question. This comes from one of our listeners. This is we have a new feature on our Patreon page where people get to donate a little bit of money and ask the guest a question.
Mm.
We call it Grill the Guest. So Eric Rhein, R-H-E-I-N, wants to know from Larry, where do you rank Gilbert among celebrity impressionists?
Number one. with a bullet. Does this guy really think that I'm going to sit here next to Gilbert? Well, I would say top 50. I don't know.
You know, Gilbert does one of the best James Masons in the business.
I've heard that.
Have him do it a little bit. And he did it for Rich Little.
Oh, yeah?
And Rich Little actually said, Gilbert, don't quit your day job.
Really?
Which was really unfair.
Yeah. Wow.
Considering your James Mason is stellar.
A few people.
Yeah, and our fans were in an uproar.
Tanner, my son, has told me about your James Mason.
Tanner is, yeah. Do a touch of James Mason for
Hey. Dr. Mengele, your plan has been canceled.
Isn't that That's great?
That is great.
Yeah.
I think I heard you doing that on the Benjamin thing, Richard Benjamin thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because he did a little right.
Because you did two different things, and he said,
Well, now you're doing the later.
Oh, yes, the early one. Oh, well, the later ones was James Mason with, "It's your destiny, Joe. You can't be Joe Farnsworth anymore."
That's good. That is good.
Oh, so before we get the hell out of here, we got to ask you about Bowling for Dollars, because you and I talked about it over the telly.
Yeah. Well,
and it's a legendary show here in New York. You told me it was a regional show. Before we turned the mics on, you were saying that there were hosts all around the country. I didn't know Wink Martindale hosted it. And
I'm pretty sure he did.
Jim Lang of The Dating Game.
Yeah, I know Jim Lang did in San Francisco, I believe.
You filled the shoes of the legendary New York Mets sportscaster Bob Murphy, who I grew up on.
Literally. The day I walked in, the first time I walked into the, we filmed it at Madison Square Garden Bowling Center, which is not there anymore. And my dressing room was the manager's office. So the first day we're taping, I go in there and he shows me to my, the little room. And I open the closet door to hang my, I had to have five suits and sport coats with me. We taped five shows in one day, every Friday. Because the show was on every night, Monday through Friday.
I remember.
And so I open this closet door and put my hanger up there. And I look down and there's this little tiny pair of men's shoes, loafers, with enormously high heels. I don't mean high heels like a woman's high. Lifts.
Lifts. Oh, yeah. He was a diminutive fellow.
He was a small guy.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, so I literally followed in his footsteps.
You were probably just in the Bob Murphy Memorial Record. Well, Gilbert was at a game. Gilbert was at a Met game, and they brought him into the booth. You were probably in the Bob Murphy Memorial Broadcast booth, and you didn't even know it. But he was the first host, and then Larry came along. And Gilbert was asking Larry before we turned the mics on if the contestants were ever boozed up.
No, but we got, I mean, the thing is, unlike the big game shows on television where you have to audition, sometimes three or four times you have to audition, and they want people that are just right for their show. They want enthusiasm.
I auditioned for Jeopardy twice, and they never called me, and I passed the test both times.
No kidding.
Never put me on the show.
Did you ever find out why?
Because white males in their 30s, which I was at the time, they have a lot of those. So they're trying to create diversity in their contestants.
Payback's a bitch.
Yeah, I was too typical.
So, this show, all you had to do to get on the show is send in a postcard. And if your postcard was picked out of the Pin Pal barrel, you would be on the show. And we never saw the guests until the day they arrived at the taping. I mean, there was no pre-checking of them or any background checks, so we got, you can imagine, all kinds of people. We got one kid, I remember, he was only about 19 years old, and he was scared to death. I always, before the show, I would sit down individually with each contestant for a couple of minutes, asking them the questions, so that I could ask them questions when they came out on the show. And I had cue cards, and I would write, he's from Brooklyn. Wife's name is, okay. So this kid, I could tell he was nervous at the pre-interview, but not terribly, So he's the first contestant on the show. Show opens and I do my little spiel and I say, okay, so let's meet our first contestant tonight on Bowling for Dollars, Paul Martin from Brooklyn, New York. And at that point, the door would open behind me. There was a guy back there actually who opened the door and closed it.
Somebody's job, job.
And then the guest would supposed to walk out. So the door opens, and he's standing there like. So I walk back, and I reach out to shake his hand so that I could pull him out. I had to drag him out into the.
It's like Ralph on the Chef of the Future.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Hum-a-na-hum-a-na-hum-a-na.
Oh, it can Corey Apple.
Yeah.
So I pull him out there and I said, Paul, welcome to the show. What kind of work do you do? And he goes, different kinds. Two questions. I realize I'm not going to get anything out of this kid. So the last thing we did with each contestant is say, who did you bring with you today to cheer you on? And then the camera would go on. There are people in the audience. He said, well, Larry, I brought my mother
and my father. I said, all right, let's meet them. The camera goes on these lovely old couples and this waving, you know. And I said, introduce them to us, Paul. And he goes, okay, that's my mother and that's my father.
It's time to hit the jackpot on Bowling for Dollars, New York's big money and big prize game show where everyone is a winner. And now for all the fun and excitement, here's the man with all the dollars and all the prizes, the kingpin himself, your host, Larry Kinney.
We're going to go bowling for dollars again. A lot of them. $760 in the jackpot already. And we'll keep climbing until somebody breaks it by rolling two straight strikes. That's all it takes. Then they go back to the lane and try for that third consecutive strike. They get the jackpot money they've already won and get a place to spend it, too. A fantastic vacation for two for an entire week in Monte Carlo on the famous French Riviera. The prize includes round-trip jet transportation and accommodations at a four-star hotel. And our contestant will tour Monaco, the jewel of the Côte d'Azur. And so will the pin pal, because when that happens, three straight strikes, the bowler and the pin pal at home win the same prize. And that happens all the way through the show.
And one more, if I can. There was a guy who, I recall that I didn't have much time to speak with him because we were on the last show of the day and we were running late, you know, so I only had time to ask him a couple of questions. And he comes out with this and this, what kind of work do you do, blah, 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 blah. And I always ask in the pre-interview, are you married or something, but I didn't have a chance to ask this guy. So, big mistake, I said, Tyrone, are you married? He said, well, yeah. And I said, what's your wife doing? He says, I don't know. I ain't seen a bitch in 3 years.
Good thing it wasn't live.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, two things. Oh, did you ever know Paul Winchell?
No, never met him.
And I don't think you told your Bogart story on the air.
Yeah, tell it. No, we had the mics off.
You told us
before. Oh, is that right?
Man, we weren't on.
Oh, okay.
It's worth telling.
It's not a great story. It's Bob Fosse was doing a movie with Dustin Hoffman, and I forget, it seems like it was Bette Midler, but I don't know. I don't think the movie ever came out because I've tried to find it, and I don't know what the name of it was. But apparently, Dustin Hoffman was supposed to, he had a line in the movie that he was supposed to do as Bogart. And the line was, stick with me, sweetheart, and I'll have your tits in cement in front of Rowan's Chinese Theater. So I do the audition, you know, and Bob Fosse likes it. And so a couple days later, I get a call, go back. I go back and record again. And he says, I want to use this, Larry, but I have to get Lauren's approval. Lauren Bacall. So I said, okay. So I went to lunch and come back, and I see her leaving the building, Lauren Bacall. Okay. I go up there, and he says, I said, did she like it? He says, Larry, I played it for her. She turned around, and there was a tear in her eye, and she said, my God, Bogey's back.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. Oh, that's what I thought. Wow, you can't get much better than that, right?
I'm going to put this out to our listeners, too. Find this movie. This Bob Fosse.
I've looked.
It wasn't Lenny. It wasn't Lenny, which came out.
No,
with,
wasn't Lenny.
With Dustin Hoffman. Something in development, something that kind of died on the vine,
I guess. That's right. It was Hoffman and Lenny, but it wasn't that one. It was after that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Now we're going to go out on a song. You guys up for one more?
Sure.
All right, Frankie, this is going to be a Paul Lynn duet.
Oh, how wonderful. This ought to be good.
We'll try to keep it to the karaoke track, but if you go off of it, don't worry about it.
Yeah, I don't know if I remember how the music goes, but I'll try.
We got a little accompaniment. Gil, you want to start
us
off?
So this will be very anti-Semitic. This is what I heard. Paul Lynn, he used to get drunk on Hollywood Squares.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
as Katie and Tanner are toasting us outside the window.
And like everyone else would drink too, but they'd be lovable drunks, joking back and forth. Paul Lynn was extremely anti-Semitic.
Really?
And he would get drunk, and he'd be sitting there at the table with the nice celebrities, and he'd be going, oh, those fucking Jews. They're the reason I don't have a career.
Oh, no.
We've had that confirmed.
Oh, my God. I remember my favorite line he ever said when he was the center square is, Paul, for the win, why do cowboys wear leather chaps? He goes, oh, because taffeta wrinkles.
I think there was a great line. One time they had Don Knotts in the original Hollywood Squares, and the question was, you have trouble sleeping nights. Are you a man or a woman? And he goes, that's why I have trouble sleeping nights.
Fantastic.
He was incredible.
Oh, you guys, sharp. You want to give this a whirl?
So I'm,
you're the G and
I
he's
guess,
the L.
Oh, is that how it goes?
Okay. Yeah, you'll each read a section.
Well, mine's going to sound like L anyway, no matter how I do it. So.
Okay.
Maybe.
You want to?
Maybe via Poland, you can do the cuckoo.
Let's see.
Okay. Now.
Okay.
Okay.
Here we go.
Both do Paul.
Here's
right.
Paul Lynn.
Okay.
Okay.
Kids, I don't know what's wrong with these kids today. Kids who can understand anything they say.
Kids, they're disobedient, disrespectful oafs. Noisy, crazy, sloppy, lazy loafers. While we're on the subject.
Kids! You can talk and talk till your face is blue. Kids, but they still do just what they want to do. Why can't they be like we were? Perfect in every way. What's the matter with kids today?
Oh, don't get me started. Kids, I've tried to raise them the best I could. Kids, laughing, where's the music? Laughing, singing, dancing, grinning morons. And while we're on the subject.
Kids, they're just impossible to control.
Kids, with their awful clothes and their rock and roll. Why can't they dance like we did? What's wrong with Sammy K? What's the matter with kids today?
That's a hit. That's a hit.
It was so far removed from the music. It doesn't even matter. Frank, if you can sew that together, you're a genius. Oh, my God. This was fun.
It was great.
Larry, good time.
Oh, thank
you. We want to acknowledge, too, that your son, your talented son, Tanner,
yes,
is here.
Who's also a great impressionist.
And your daughter-in-law, Katie.
Yep.
Talented people, and your daughter is a comedian. She was on The State.
Yes.
She was on Viva Variety.
Yes.
Carrie.
Currently on Two Broke Girls occasionally. And
a talented family.
Yeah. Yeah, we think so.
And I want to thank Frank Rotarosa
for
suggesting Larry as a guest.
Larry said he'd give me a 50, so I...
Do they still make those?
Did you do Lion-O on Family Guy?
Last question. I did one episode. Yeah. It was kind of a funny line. The idea was the star of the show, what's his name? The old man, the guy.
Seth MacFarlane.
No. I mean, no. I know he's the
creator. Oh, Peter Griffin.
Peter. Yeah. Peter and I think the... one of the other guys is in San Francisco, and they're in the car, and Peter says, yeah, but you find a lot of weird couples living together in this town, huh? He flashed to an apartment where Lion-O and Chitara and Snarf are living. So Lion-O's standing there deep in thought, and Chitara walks through the room, and she says, what's going on, Lion-O? He says, I don't know. But I have a feeling that Mumra's up to something. Whatever it is, it can't be good. She says, I'm going to the John. So she goes in the bathroom. Lion-O takes out the Sword of Omens, which gives him sight beyond sight, and he points it toward the bathroom door and says, sight beyond sight. Sword of Omens. And Snarf comes through and says,
what you doing, Lion-O?
And Lion-O says, oh, nothing, just, you want to get stoned?
So you were a horse on Family Guy.
Yes.
Yeah, so you both did Family Guy.
Yeah, I remember, the horse shows, the horse saves Peter from being lynched down south. Mm. And then he goes, Horsey, you saved my life. And I go, no problem, Peter. And then he goes, wow, Gilbert Gottfried.
Oh, that's great. I love it.
We could go on, Larry, but.
Well, it was great. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm exhausted from laughing. Did you have fun?
I had a great time.
Good.
I really did. Thank you both, and thanks, Frank, out there.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you, Tanner. Thank you, Andrea.
I'm Gilbert Gottfried. This has been Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host, Frank Santopadre. And we've had one of the greatest voiceover guys in the business, Larry Kenny.
The God of Voices.
That's funny.
Thanks, Larry.
This was a
kick for us.
This is Gilbert Gottfried on Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host, Frank Santopadre. And Frank Verderosa is our engineer on the control board. And our special guest today, the wonderful, incredible, well, he's not bad. Voiceover artist extraordinaire and all around the nice guy, Larry Kenny. Thank you and good night.
Thanks, Larry.
That ought to hold a little bastard.
You know where that's from, right?
Yes. Was that
like Uncle Don?
Yes.
Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast is produced by Dara Gottfried and Frank Santopadre, with audio production by Frank Verderosa. Our researchers are Paul Rayburn and Andrea Simmons. Web and social media is handled by Mike McPadden, Greg Pear, Nancy Chinchar, and John Bradley Seals. Photography by Charles Eshelman. Special audio contributions by John Beach. Special thanks to John Murray, John Fotiatis, and Nutmeg Creative. Especially Sam Giovanco and Daniel Farrell for their assistance.